Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with As It Is, a program that helps you learn and improve your American English. Today we have two very interesting stories for you. The first one deals with the Internet. It has become an important part of our lives. We often wonder how we ever got along without it. But some people wonder if it has become too important for many of us. We will explain. Then we will hear how the Internet and new technology are changing journalism and how we see and hear the news. Two important stories that will tell you about our world and help you with your English all at the same time. If you are ready, here is part one. The Internet is one of the most popular forms of technology. But can using the Internet have the same effect as taking a drug? As we hear from Jonathan Evans, the answer seems to be yes, in at least one country.
China says many teenagers are Internet addicts. It says they have grown dependent on the Internet. In fact, China feels that Internet addiction is the biggest threat to its teenagers. Some critics even call the Internet electronic heroin. In 2008, China became one of the first countries to declare Internet addiction an official medical condition. Experts released a report that defined the condition, or disorder. It said people with Internet addiction disorder spend more than 6 hours online doing something other than work or study. Based on the definition, China has over 20 million Internet addicts. The condition has led to the creation of over 250 camps within China. They are designed to treat young addicts. The first addiction camp opened in 2005 in the capital, Beijing. The camps treat the country's young addicts for their dependence on the Internet and video gaming. Gaming appears to be the most addictive Internet behavior. Teenagers can spend 3 to 4 months at a camp. Once there, the patients are required to do demanding physical exercises and take medication. Some patients reportedly are placed in rooms by themselves for up to 10 days. Eric Harwit is a professor of Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii. Professor Harwit says Chinese parents are worried because they take education very seriously. He says they saw a lot of teenagers start to lose interest in school and spend their time playing games on the Internet. He adds that the parents of Internet-addicted teens want to cure their children. Some even drug their children to take them to the camps. Shosh Shlom and Hila Medalia are filmmakers from Israel. They released a documentary called Web Junkie last month. It tells about the Internet addiction camps. Their film was produced at the Daqing Treatment Center in Beijing. Hila Medalia says there are no showers at the camp. The teenagers wake up very early in the morning. She says it is like the addicts are doing military training. But Ms. Medalia says camp officials believe conditions like these provide a discipline or sense of self-control that the patients need. The center urges parents to stay at the camps. Officials at the Daqing Treatment Center said that 70% of their patients overcame internet addiction. Eric Harwit says once the teenage patients leave the camp, they are not supposed to play games, but they still have to use the internet. He says a lot of research is now done online. He wonders how anyone can say that part of the internet is good, but another part is bad. China is not the only country dealing with internet addiction. South Korea has opened over 100 treatment centers for teenagers suffering from the effects of electronic heroin. I'm Jonathan Evans.
The internet and developments in technology are quickly changing how people receive news and how reporters provide it. There are now more ways than ever to tell a story. Katie Weaver tells us about one training program for people interested in working in the new media.
A university in California has built a high-tech newsroom to train student reporters how to work in the new world of journalism. Faith Miller is one of those students. She says working in the newsroom taught her how much time and effort is needed to report a story.
I did not expect that in school I would be reporting on real stories, and I did not know how much work goes into it.
Ms. Miller attends the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Journalism. Earlier generations of reporters worked either in newsrooms or as television or radio broadcasters. But today, members of the press must be able to report news in all the ways people want to receive it. Willow Bay is the director of the Annenberg School of Journalism. She says reporters today must know how to use technology to help them tell stories.
Today, we expect journalists to be able to use all sorts of technological tools to research stories, to vet that research, to analyze that research. We expect them to be fluid in multimedia storytelling skills. We expect them increasingly to be their own marketing and distribution arms, to get their stories in front of audiences and to spread those stories as far as they can.
They learn all those skills in the school's new media center. It was built like a newsroom. In the center of the newsroom is the assignment desk. That is where reporters learn what they are to investigate and report about. The newsroom has many televisions. The center also has more than 90 work areas where students can work with others on reports for television, radio, and the internet. Robert Hernandez is a professor of digital journalism. He says reporters in the future must be at ease using new technology. He says they should also learn computer programming languages.
They need to know how the web works and be able to tinker with it.
Professor Hernandez says there are many ways reporters can tell stories today.
You can do 360 panorama through your phone, right? We can talk about what a tornado looks like, how it rips trees out of the ground. Through their phone, there's an app to kind of stitch that together.
Serena Cha is the director of the Media Center. She says students there are learning how to use new technology responsibly.
In the journalism arena, we've got to consider carefully, how do we teach students to use the tools responsibly? So yes, new technology often raises new questions because you're able to manipulate reality even more than before.
The Media Center at Annenberg offers many tools of the field. But students also study the skills linked to traditional journalism, how to write an interesting story that is based on facts, fairness, and balance. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington on The Voice of America.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Today, we continue our series of expert suggestions for academic writing. Our guest is Jennifer Ahern Dodson, Assistant Professor of the Practice in Writing Studies at Duke University in North Carolina. Ms. Ahern Dodson starts a conversation with both students and professors planning to write a paper or essay. She asks about their earlier writing experiences. Were they negative or positive? She advises that you are not alone if you have had problems with your writing. She says everyone struggles with writing.
Writing is hard. All writers struggle at some point. And even if writing has come easy for you at some point in your work as a student, that eventually you're going to hit a roadblock. And so part of what I like to get folks thinking about, besides writing hard for everybody, is to really take a moment to think about their past writing experiences and when the writing was going well, what was happening. When the writing wasn't going well, what was happening.
She says most people's negative writing experiences happen because a very special formula is required for a paper, including an exact length.
And so they primarily focus on and worry about what the final product has to look like how many pages of a research essay, or if it is second or third language, you know, punctuation, grammar, like making sure it gets communicated in the right language. And so focusing on the end makes it really hard to get started.
Another problem can arise when the need to do well on a paper is extremely important.
Like a timed essay exam or a college application essay or a research paper that is at the end of the semester and it's tied to their entire grade for the class. So worrying about what would happen if they don't do well, like bad grades, don't get into college, creates, of course, significant anxiety, and that can make it harder to get the writing done.
Then she and the people she's helping move to more positive projects. She says usually when writing comes easily, the writers feel they have something important to say. The teacher advises asking yourself questions. What personal understanding of the subject can you bring to your paper? Why is this subject important? For whom is it meaningful? Who will be reading it?
Think about who your audience is and what it is that you really want to say to them. What that can do is help you switch the focus from the final product and what it can look like and really more on what you have to offer, your particular perspective.
She says that is an important change for all writers. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. Coming soon, Jennifer Ahern Dodson talks about doing research, sitting down to write, and sharing your writing with others. I'm Jerry Watson.
Music. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On a cold and cloudy day in March of 1861, Abraham Lincoln became the 16th President of the United States. In his inaugural speech, the new president announced the policy that he would follow toward the southern states that had left the Union. Lincoln said no state had a legal right to secede. The Union could not be broken. He said he would enforce federal laws in every state. And he promised not to surrender any federal property in the states that seceded. Lincoln said if force was necessary to protect the Union, then force would be used. His policy was soon tested. This week in our series, Jack Weitzel and Jack Moyles discuss the dispute over the federal base that was being built at Fort Sumter.
On his second day as president, Lincoln received some bad news from Fort Sumter at Charleston, South Carolina. Major Robert Anderson, the commander of the small United States force at Sumter, wrote that his food supplies were low. At most, said Anderson, there was enough food for 40 days. Unless he and his men received more supplies, they would have to leave the fort. Lincoln wanted to keep Fort Sumter. It was one of the few United States forts in the South still held by federal forces, and he had promised not to give up any federal property in the states that seceded.
But getting food to Fort Sumter would be a very difficult job. The fort was built on an island in Charleston Harbor. It was surrounded by southern artillery. Southern gunboats guarded the port. To get supplies to Anderson and his men, a ship would have to fight its way to Sumter. Such a battle was sure to begin a bitter civil war. There also was the danger that fighting would cause slave states still in the Union to secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
The Army Chief, General Scott, warned Lincoln that it was too late to get supplies to Fort Sumter. He said Southern defenses around the fort were so strong that a major military effort would be necessary. He said it would take months to prepare the warships and soldiers for such an effort. Major Anderson and his men at Sumter, he said, could not wait that long. There was another plan, however, that might work. It was proposed to Lincoln by Captain Gustavus Fox of the Navy Department. Captain Fox said soldiers and supplies could be sent down to Charleston in ships. Outside the entrance to the harbor, on a dark night, they could be put into small boats and pulled by tugs to the fort. Fox said a few warships could be sent to prevent southern gunboats from interfering.
Lincoln liked this plan. He asked his cabinet for advice. If it were possible to send supplies to Sumter, he asked, would it be wise to do so? Postmaster General Blair was the only member of the cabinet to answer yes. Treasury Secretary Chase was for the plan only if Lincoln was sure it would not mean war. Secretary of State Seward and the others opposed it. They said it would be better to withdraw Major Anderson and his men. They felt that now was not the time to start a civil war. This opposition in the cabinet caused Lincoln to postpone action on the Fox plan. But he sent two men separately to Charleston to get him information on the situation there. One was Captain Fox. The other was a close friend, Ward Lamon.
In Charleston, Fox met with Governor Pickens. He explained that he wished to talk with Major Anderson, not to give him orders, but to find out what the situation really was. Governor Pickens agreed. A Confederate boat carried Fox to Sumter. Anderson told Fox that the last of the food would be gone on April 15th. Ward Lamon went to Charleston after Fox returned to Washington. He, too, met with Governor Pickens and Major Anderson. The South Carolina governor asked Lamon to give Lincoln this message. Nothing can prevent war except a decision by the President of the United States to accept the secession of the South. If an attempt is made to put more men in Fort Sumter, a war cry will be sounded from every hilltop and valley in the South. Lamon reported to Lincoln that the arrival of even a boatload of food at Sumter would lead to fighting.
At the end of March, Lincoln held another cabinet meeting and again asked what should be done about Fort Sumter. Should an attempt be made to get supplies to Major Anderson? This time, three members of the cabinet voted yes, and three voted no. When the meeting ended, Lincoln wrote an order for the Secretary of War. He told him to prepare to move men and supplies by sea to Fort Sumter. He said they should be ready to sail as early as April 6th, only 1 week away.
On April 4th, Lincoln called Captain Fox to the White House. He told him that the government was ready to take supplies to Fort Sumter. He said Fox would lead the attempt. Lincoln showed Fox a message he was sending to Governor Pickens in South Carolina. It read, "This is to inform you that an attempt will be made to supply Fort Sumter with food only. If this attempt is not opposed, no effort will be made to throw in men, arms, or ammunition." Governor Pickens received the message on April 8th. He immediately sent it by telegraph to Confederate President Jefferson Davis at Montgomery, Alabama. Davis called a meeting of his cabinet to discuss what should be done. He asked if Fort Sumter should be seized before supplies could arrive.
Former United States Senator Robert Toombs of Georgia was the Confederate Secretary of State. He told Davis, "Firing upon that fort will begin a civil war greater than any the world has ever seen. I cannot advise you." Later in the meeting, Toombs urged Davis not to attack the fort. "Mr. President," he said, "at this time, it is suicide, murder, and will lose us every friend in the North. You will strike a hornet's nest which extends from mountains to oceans. Millions now quiet will swarm out and sting us to death. It is not necessary. It puts us in the wrong. It will kill us."
On April 10th, Jefferson Davis sent his decision to the Confederate commander at Charleston, General Pierre Beauregard. He told Beauregard to demand the surrender of Fort Sumter. If Major Anderson refused, then the general was to destroy the fort. The surrender demand was carried to Sumter the next day by a group of Confederate officers. They said Anderson and his men must leave the fort, but they could take with them their weapons and property. And they were offered transportation to any United States port they named.
Anderson rejected the demand. As he walked with the Confederate officers back to their boat, he asked if General Beauregard would open fire on Sumter immediately. No, they said. He would be told later when the shooting would start. Anderson then told the Southerners, "If you do not shell us to pieces, hunger will force us out in a few days." General Beauregard informed the Confederate government in Montgomery that Anderson refused to surrender. He also reported the major's statement that Sumter had only enough food for a few more days.
New orders were sent to Beauregard. Jefferson Davis said there was no need to attack the fort if hunger would soon force the United States soldiers to leave. But he said Anderson must say exactly when he and his men would leave. And he said Anderson must promise not to fire on Confederate forces. If Anderson agreed to this, then Confederate guns would remain silent. This offer was carried to Fort Sumter a few minutes before midnight, April 11th. Anderson discussed the offer with his officers and then wrote his answer. He would leave the fort on April 15th if the Confederates made no hostile act against Fort Sumter or against the United States flag. He would not leave, however, if before then he received new orders or supplies.
This did not satisfy the three Confederate officers who brought Beauregard's message. They handed Anderson a short note. It said, "We have the honor to inform you that General Beauregard will open fire on Fort Sumter in 1 hour, at 20 minutes after 4, on the morning of April 12, 1861. The major shook hands with Beauregard's representatives, and they left the fort. Anderson and his officers woke their men and told them to prepare for battle. At Fort Johnson, across the harbor, Confederate gunners also were getting ready. These men would fire the first shot at Sumter. That explosion would signal the other guns surrounding the fort to open fire.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Jack Weitzel and Jack Moyles. You can find transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us at twitter.com/voalearnenglish. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.